It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. From inflation to federal budget cuts and uncertainty, food assistance programs in Wisconsin are being stretched thin.
In just a bit, we'll hear from a UW Extension program that's laying off food educators who work with people receiving food assistance.
First, in March, the U.S. Department of Agriculture froze $500 million from the Emergency Food Assistance Program, which supplies food to pantries around the United States. And recipients of SNAP food assistance have seen cuts as well.
And some food pantries here in Wisconsin say they won't be able to make up for that lost support.
Ellen Carlson is executive director at Way Forward Resources, which runs a food pantry for Dane County residents. Ellen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen, I've been looking over the timeline of freezes to funding, cuts to funding, congressional changes to funding. My head is spinning. Where are we now when it comes to funding that affects your services?
Yeah, so most of the dollars that come to food pantries actually comes through food, right, through that emergency food assistance program. And we know that there's less food in the food system. There's less food going to our food banks, which means there's less food coming to our food pantries. And so we're sort of bracing for those changes as they continue to come.
What has this meant? Because there was a freeze at one point already this year. The freeze, I think, ended. What have you seen actually coming through your doors? How has that affected you?
Yeah, there's, like I said, we get most of our food through the food bank, and they're doing everything that they can, right? They're kind of our first stopgap. So we're really grateful for those partnerships because that food comes through them, and then they do their best to get us as much food as possible. We haven't seen a lot of changes yet, but we've heard that there's going to be less protein in the system and a lot of less food in the system coming in these next few months.
Right. Apart from funding changes, everybody knows about inflation and food costs going up. I imagine, as somebody who is part of this food supply, that's got to affect you.
Absolutely. We're definitely seeing that it's harder for us to purchase food because it just costs a lot more. We're getting a lot less food through our food rescue systems because grocery stores are just really tightening and being really careful about the food that they order and get out. Food costs going up is really hard for people who are shopping in the stores and using their budgets as best that they can. So that means more people to our food pantries.
Right. And I wanted to talk about that demand side. What are you seeing as far as the need for food pantries in yours? And I assume you're in touch with colleagues around the
Absolutely.
State.
Absolutely. We've all seen just tremendous increases in the need for food pantries. In the last few years, we've had four times as many people coming to our food pantry as we'd had in the past. And we know that with everything that's coming up with inflation and these decreases in SNAP, that more people are going to be coming to us.
I wanted to ask about those SNAP changes. What are the changes that are going to affect the demand for your services?
Yeah, we know that more people are going to be without those services, and so they're going to come to food pantries to make up those holes in their budgets.
The state recently passed a budget. Is that part of your ecology there, state funding?
Yes. We know that there's some food coming, right, through our food banks, and there'll be some more food coming there. We're really excited about that because there couldn't be a better time for the state to have those dollars in the budget for our food pantries. But we know it's not going to make up for the loss in the SNAP funding that people are getting.
When it comes to federal funding, whether it's SNAP or that emergency food assistance program or others, what are some of the big question marks in your mind that haven't been resolved
yet? Oh, my gosh, there's so many question marks. I mean, we don't really know what those impacts are going to be and how many people are going to be coming to our food pantries. We also don't really know the exact amounts. You know, like you said, there's been lots of changes in that TFAP program and what exactly is going to come our way. So we're just bracing for those changes and really working with our community to get the word out.
People might hear this and say, okay, what is the best way to help? What's the best way to help out my local food pantry, whether that's in Dane County in yours or elsewhere in the state?
Absolutely. What I always encourage people to do is actually reach out to those food pantries because every food pantry is going to see every situation look a little differently. That TFAP foods are going, if there's a reduction in those, is going to affect every single food pantry slightly differently. Food pantries are going to need dollars. They're going to need donations of food. They're going to need more volunteers.
When it comes to people donating food, I know sometimes the temptation is, why do we buy that? That's gross. I guess I'll donate it. What are the ways to make sure that the food people donate, and money, obviously, yes. is something that's going to make a difference. It's something that is going to help serve the community.
So most food pantries do have a top 10 list or a list of things that they need, because what they're doing is they're procuring food from TFAP. They're procuring food from their food banks. They're getting food in lots of different ways. And so it's really important that when people donate food, it fills holes. I actually just often tell people, if you want to help a local food pantry, think about the non-perishable foods that you and your family like. Donate those to a food pantry, because there will be a family who needs those as well.
Ellen, thanks so much for joining
thanks
us
for
in the studio.
Me.
That's Ellen Carlson, Executive Director at Way Forward Resources, which runs a food pantry for Dane County residents. Talked about cuts to the Emergency Food Assistance Program and SNAP and how that affects the food pantry's work. Now, at the end of last month, the UW Division of Extension announced that they'd be discontinuing their FoodWise program, which provides nutrition education to low-income people and families. They cite federal funding cuts as the primary reason. FoodWise was funded by the National Education and Obesity Prevention Grant Program that was eliminated in the Congressional Budget Reconciliation Bill. Extension will be laying off more than 90 employees who work on that program. It continues till the end of September. Amber Canto is director for the Extension Institute for Health and Well-Being. Amber, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about the work you've been doing at FoodWise?
Yeah. So our FoodWise program, as you noted, is a community-based nutrition education program. We have been working in 70 of 72 Wisconsin counties with support from the SNAP-Ed grant, otherwise known as the National Obesity Prevention Grant. That program allows us to do a lot of different things around the state in support of teaching lifelong healthy eating and physical activity habits. We provide nutrition education to individuals in schools, at food pantries, at community gardens, but we also work with a number of partners around the state to support access to healthy foods and physical activity opportunities as well.
So say I was a younger person with a new family, trying to figure out how to make ends meet with my food budget. What kind of services might I have been getting from FoodWise?
Yeah, it's a great question. We have been able to provide family-based nutrition education that supports cooking skill development, as well as teaching about how to make the most of a limited food budget, whether that's comparing prices at the store, whether it's developing a shopping list, and whether it's using a number of different community resources and economic supports to offset perhaps limited food budgets. So these programs look different depending on the communities in which we work. It might be at a community center. It might be at a library. It really is responsive to the local needs and community context.
How have you measured the impact of the FoodWise services?
Yeah, we have a robust evaluation system that we have used. It actually builds from a national evaluation framework that has allowed us to develop metrics that we use around the state, regardless of a variety of those community contexts. And so what we have seen is that our programs are making an impact. We have youth that are reducing their consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages. We have youth that are getting more physical activity in a day. And we see that a number of individuals, over 70%, in fact, who are participating in our programs are using food resource management skills to extend their food dollars.
Right. I mean, no secret to people who cook. It is generally cheaper to cook your own food rather than buying prepared foods or restaurant foods, things like that. Do you see that kind of savings for people trying to make that, say, that SNAP budget go a little further?
We do. We have seen through our evaluation efforts that people are extending their food dollars in response to the education that we've been able to deliver.
What does this funding cut mean? I mentioned layoffs coming. How big an impact does this all have on your services?
It's a big impact. So we, as you noted, have informed staff at the end of July that we would be winding down program services. That means layoff notices to over 90 staff. Right now, we are working closely to communicate the impacts of this funding loss with our over 850 partners statewide. We are working to wrap up scheduled programming that we had through the rest of this month and into September. And while we hope to be able to sustain some of these efforts beyond September 30th, we know it will be at a greatly reduced scale.
Now, what kind of things are in the works to try to, at least on a limited level, keep some of these things going?
We are exploring all possible pathways that we have available to us, whether it's working with new and existing partners to see if there is alternative funding that could support and sustain some of this work. Some of that might look like local fund donations, alternative grants. But at this time, there is no significant level of support that will allow us to continue this programming at the current scale.
What are your worries now for the people who have received this kind of service in recent years?
Yeah, we have heard from partners that they are concerned as well. This is a loss of a decades-long program in the state of Wisconsin as well as nationwide. And we don't really know what the level of support or alternative pathways are going to be for those youth who have provided, who have received nutrition education in schools, for example, or in our community sites.
Are there ways you're hoping to, you know, even if it's not on the ground, try to provide this kind of information, I don't know, online or via those library partners or others you mentioned?
Wonderful question. We are currently working with our state team and leadership to assess what other options and pathways we might be able to continue to provide information to the public, as you noted, whether that be online, through other alternative sources, to our partners. As soon as we have greater clarity on what that looks like, we'll be communicating more broadly with the public.
And just briefly, if there's somebody, a local community leader who hasn't been involved with the program thinking, gosh, I wish we'd had something like that, is there a way they can reach out and talk about the services you provided and see what they could try to replicate?
Yeah, please contact your local extension office. We have staff all around the state who are working in and in support of Wisconsin communities statewide. They'll be able to connect you with additional information about the program we have offered, as well as other resources statewide in the event there's something that we can do to support and sustain some of this work.
And Amber, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Amber Canto is director for the Extension Institute for Health and Well-Being. She joined us for a look at the end of the Extension's FoodWise Nutrition Education Program, which lost its funding when the Congressional Budget Reconciliation Bill passed last month. We also heard from Ellen Carlson, executive director at Way Forward Resources, which runs a food pantry for Dane County residents.
Coming up, Democratic socialists make strong showings in New York and Minneapolis mayoral races.
These values to how we can better care for ourselves, for our children, for our state, our workers. This is what candidates like Mamdani and Fateh are speaking about.
The View from Wisconsin's Socialist Caucus, next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Exploration for metallic mines is fairly rare, but in Taylor County, mining company Greenlight Wisconsin is drilling for copper and gold.
Those metals haven't been mined in Wisconsin for almost 30 years, but that could change. As drilling is ongoing, Danielle Kading reports, Wisconsin tribes and environmentalists are worried about potential harm to water, wetlands, and cultural sites.
Just off a gravel road, heavy mats cover mud on an access route to the site where Greenlight Wisconsin has just finished drilling a hole for copper and gold. A backhoe and a skid steer sit next to a drill rig in the National Forest. The company's exploration director, Eric Quigley, says crews are sealing the first two of six holes that were drilled up to 1,000 feet down.
They're mixing batches of cement, pumping them down the hole, filling it from the bottom to the top.
This site is part of the Bend deposit, and it's believed to contain around 4 million tons of copper and gold. Steve Donahue is a director on the mining company's board. He hopes the cores of bedrock will show evidence of those metals and others like tellurium that are used in electronics and solar panels.
One of the things that we're interested in as Greenlight is those key metals that are going to be important from both a domestic economic security standpoint, but also metals that are going to be important for decarbonizing the energy industry.
But a mine is a major undertaking, and even exploratory drilling has some environmentalists and residents concerned. This month, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources issued a notice of noncompliance to Greenlight after its contractor was unable to fully seal a drill hole in line with state regulations. Company officials and state regulators say there's no threat to groundwater, but tribal and environmental advocates say monitoring would be helpful to rule out any contamination. Just down the road, the company's drilling operations have been drawing up to 1,500 gallons of water a day from the North Fork of the Yellow River. Donahue says people have been visiting the site almost daily as Medford resident Jim Shaw drives by.
We're just out for a ride today.
Shaw says he used to log this forest with his uncle and cousin. He doesn't have a problem with drilling or mining in the area.
I'm okay with it. I mean, I think there's enough people that monitor things, and I mean, it's a natural resource, you know. I mean, why not? That's my opinion of it.
Even so, he questions whether something drastic could happen. He says he's heard about impacts from the Flambeau mine. That mine shut down in 1997 and was a catalyst for the state's sulfide mining moratorium. After nearly 20 years, that moratorium was repealed in 2017. Environmental groups decried that policy change. Now environmental and tribal advocates say Greenlight's plans for future drilling need more thorough review. Dave Bluen with Sierra Club Wisconsin says the Forest Service should conduct an environmental assessment to protect wetlands, water, and cultural sites.
It ensures that the natural resources that deserve protection at the site are actually located, found, identified, and planned for.
The Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission works on behalf of Wisconsin's Ojibwe tribes and their treaty rights. The agency's environmental section leader, John Coleman, says any future drilling should occur on frozen ground after state regulators identified additional wetlands at the site.
The concern is that this be done in the most protective way possible so that there isn't damage to natural or cultural resources.
The Forest Service has indicated the project may receive a lower level of review as the company seeks a prospecting permit. Federal agencies have been directed to speed up permitting under President Donald Trump's executive order to unleash American energy. As exploration continues, Greenlight's Donahue says they're still years away from a potential mine, but company officials believe it's possible.
A mining operation can be designed to be protective of the environment and provide good economic benefits.
If the company does pursue a mine, regulators say it would undergo a multi-year study and extensive environmental review. It could be a decade before any mine is possible. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Socialist candidates in the Democratic Party are showing early signs of success in two major mayoral elections across the country.
In New York City, State Representative Zoran Mamdani won the Democratic primary in June and continues to lead in the polls.
A similar dynamic is playing out in Minneapolis, where State Senator Omar Fateh won the endorsement of his local Democratic Party over the incumbent candidate.
As socialists across the country seek to capitalize on this momentum, we check in with the Socialist Caucus in Wisconsin State Assembly, which started with two members in 2023. Democratic Representative Darren Madison of Milwaukee was one of the founding members, and Democratic Representative Francesca Hong of Madison is also part of this caucus. I talked with them last week and asked Hong about her reaction to those mayoral races in New York and Minneapolis.
It's great to see candidates who are relatable speak clearly to the need for more affordable ways to live and what our shared values are as Americans, as people in this country and their various states.
And we're seeing these candidates have success in large metro areas, in blue states. And Representative Madison, you're sitting in Milwaukee, Wisconsin's largest city. Do you think this kind of movement can spread to less urban, more purple areas in Wisconsin outside of Madison and Milwaukee?
Yeah, it absolutely can. I spent my first term talking with folks around the state about my identity as a Democratic Socialist. And I think there's one thing, you know, that folks, Wisconsinites all share, right? And that's a sense of solidarity, right? With our neighbors, especially when it means giving up our short-term comfort or privilege to fight for each other's long-term freedoms, right? Everybody wants the freedom to thrive in Wisconsin, and we can only get there by looking inward and how we support each other, right? And that starts with communities first, which no matter where you are, whether that's Milwaukee or Superior or Beloit, there are community members gathering together, building systems of mutual aid so that we all can move towards a system where we all have the ability to thrive. When I share that message with folks, whether they are in the reddest counties or the bluest counties, they can understand that.
You know, the term socialist can carry negative connotations like government overreach or associations with communism, and it can get weaponized. How important do you think that label is in all of this? And I'm wondering, first with you, Representative Hong, what does it mean to you, that label?
Government overreach is happening with the Trump regime now. They are gutting SNAP benefits, taking away food from our children, making it harder for folks to have high quality education in our public institutions. We're seeing record amounts and billions of dollars in tax breaks when working class people are not able to get their fair share. And so to me, the S word, socialism, this is more about ensuring that working class people have folks who are not only fighting for them, but fighting alongside them to ensure that every American and people in this country have the economic freedom, again, to be able to take care of themselves and not a state that is overreaching and going into their lives to take away resources that folks have been fighting for and absolutely deserve.
We're talking with members of the Wisconsin Assembly Socialist Caucus about the popularity of Democratic Socialist candidates in mayoral elections in both Minneapolis and New York, what it means to Wisconsin in this moment. We have Representatives Francesca Hong of Madison and Darren Madison of Milwaukee who stay with us. Representative Hong, why did you join the caucus?
Shared values. As a working class person, I'm a single mom. I'm one of the few members who are working a wage job because my current salary in the assembly is not a living wage, living in Madison. I think having candidates who identify, have shared lived experiences of those who are working class folks in Wisconsin allows us to really understand these values and knowing, again, that government can be a force of good. The folks that I feel safe with ensuring that they understand my lived experiences is the Socialist Caucus. And so I am still a Democrat. I am a Democratic Socialist. I am a single mom. I am someone who is proud to be in the service industry as a line cook and a bartender. And I think the policies and the work, the community organizing we are doing in our caucus makes the entire Democratic Caucus stronger.
But then what are the sticking points? What are the tensions with established Democrats from not joining the caucus?
It's not so much a tension as it is that they aren't sure yet if that's what their communities want them to identify as. I think when we speak clearly to the working class values and the current needs of working class people, we're speaking to the policies that are rooted in socialism, but that we don't have to necessarily always be like the multiple identities that I have. I think more Democrats should really speak to multiple identities that they have. And so folks don't always want to be labeled, and that's completely okay. They want to build their policy, their narrative around their values, but those values are shared socialist values oftentimes.
As we close, Representative Madison, what are you watching for from these mayoral races in Minneapolis and in New York?
I'm watching the people. I'm watching to see how particularly young people are showing up in these new election cycles. Right now, folks have not been able to see a socialist mayor in a very long time across this country. But right now, you also see young people engaging in politics in a way that they haven't in a long time, taking ownership over what happens in their community in ways that they haven't in a long time, building systems of mutual aid where governmental policies or nonprofits fail. They are, you know, young people are doing some amazing things. And these candidates who are running in both New York and in Minnesota are building a broad coalition, and they're activating a new voter base that have been taking these past elections from the couch. Mm-hmm. So this is an exciting moment for politics across the country, and could be an exciting moment for Wisconsin. So I'm looking forward to seeing what happens.
Representatives Madison and Honk, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
That is Darren Madison, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 10th District in the State Assembly, which covers parts of northeastern Milwaukee County, and Francesca Hong, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 76th District in the Assembly, which includes parts of downtown and the north and east sides of Madison. They're both members of the State Assembly's Socialist Caucus, and they were with us to share their thoughts on Democratic Socialist candidates in New York City and Minneapolis gaining ground in their mayoral elections. Now we turn our attention to Milwaukee's socialist history to explore what lessons we can learn from political leaders of the past. Joel Rast is a professor of political science and director of the Urban Studies Programs and the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. Joel, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
So getting us up to speed on some of this history, how much influence did socialism have on Milwaukee politics in the early to mid-20th century? Can you give us a really brief run through?
Sure. Milwaukee socialism dates back to around the turn of the 20th century. Milwaukee had three socialist mayors during the 20th century. By the year 1960, when the third socialist mayor finally stepped down, Frank Zeidler, somebody who is well known to people here in Milwaukee still. Hmm. Milwaukee socialism started out as something, you know, in many ways very different from what we think of as socialism today, and even what we think of as kind of democratic socialism, you know, of the kind that Bernie Sanders or Zoran Mamdani are advocating. So back in the early 20th century, many cities were run by political machines, which were very corrupt and in many cases not efficient. Milwaukee socialists were very focused on what kind of working people needed in terms of government services, and infrastructure was a big part of that. So public health infrastructure, for example, sewers, you know, clean water. Back in the early 20th century, cities were experiencing lots of disease, tuberculosis, other kinds of, you know, very serious fatal diseases. And so that was, you know, something that Milwaukee socialists thought needed to be addressed by government. And the term sewer socialism was given to Milwaukee socialists by other socialists outside of Milwaukee who use that term in a more of a pejorative kind of way, basically, you know, making the claim that Milwaukee socialists weren't real socialists, right? That they were really, you know, they weren't revolutionary socialists interested in, you know, getting rid of capitalism and replacing it with something else.
Why do you think we're seeing Democratic socialism having this moment or starting to rise in popularity again more recently. What is changing?
Well, I think there's a dissatisfaction with what the Democratic Party has been doing for the past several decades, becoming much more aligned with business, much more aligned with kind of globalism, which has hurt a lot of working class people. I mean, let's face it, you know, Democratic kind of mainstream Democratic policies have not done very much for working people over the past several decades, with some important exceptions, Obamacare, for example. And then there's, you know, the other side of the political spectrum on the right, which claims to be a working class kind of party now, but is also, you know, if you look a little bit more closely, is also not doing a lot for working people. Rhetorically, they're making that sort of argument. But, you know, again, if you look at the actual policies, then people who can kind of, you know, see what's going on realize that that's not going to help working people all that much either. So we have, you know, democratic socialism now as an alternative to both of those approaches, which, you know, some people are seeing as a superior alternative. The question is, how far will that go? And will people, you know, begin to gravitate towards that perspective in large enough numbers to win elections outside of, you know, small sort of pockets where we have elected officials now?
Joel, thank you for this history and this context. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
Political science professor Joel Rast is director of the Urban Studies Programs and the Center for Economic Development at UW-Milwaukee. He was with us to share some of Milwaukee's socialist history. And earlier, we heard from members of the Wisconsin Assembly Socialist Caucus about the momentum they're seeing for Democratic socialist candidates now.
Coming up, an author from Eau Claire shares his new book about being the father of a transgender child and tells us the goals behind the memoir.
Bring some humanity to an issue that's often politicized and caricatured, and just to kind of show, like, hey, here's one family's sort of response in terms of how they're dealing with this.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Transgender children and their families come up a lot in news and politics.
But in a new book, an Eau Claire writer shares the personal story of a family navigating transgender identity in real life.
Andrew Patry joins us. He's a high school English teacher and writer based in Eau Claire, and his new book is called Clumsy Love, A Father's Journey Parenting His Transgender Daughter. Andrew, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
What moved you to want to share your story and your family's story in this new book?
I had self-published a collection of poems in 2006. And the last poem in that collection was a poem entitled Simon. And I remember writing that poem and thinking there are these, we were becoming aware of aspects of our child that did not sort of conform to, you know, the society's definition of what, you know, a young boy should be in terms of interests and things like that. And I remember talking with my wife at the time, thinking I feel like, you know, we're sort of on the cusp of something kind of huge happening with our child here. And sure enough, it was within, I think, the year after that is when Simone had sort of came out to us as transgender. And our you know, all our lives kind of, you know, changed. And I started to document just in little writing pieces that I was doing at the time, some of these moments. I was at a writing retreat in Eau Claire, and the person kind of overseeing our cohort of nonfiction writers. But he just said that, I think you need to write this book and there's a larger story to tell here. And I had no idea how to do that, coming from, you know, just writing smaller pieces, poems, brief essays. And so he really became a mentor to me, and, you know, kind of helped me see the importance of telling this story. And so that's kind of how it began. This would have been in the end of the summer 2019.
What were you hoping that other families, maybe in a similar situation, would take away from you putting these stories on paper?
So I think what I was hoping, I mean, on the one hand, just to bring some humanity to an issue that's often, you know, politicized and caricatured, and just to kind of show, like, hey, here's one family's sort of response in terms of how they're dealing with this. And also to be kind of honest with, you know, it wasn't necessarily a smooth road of like, yeah, our kid's transgender, cool, let's just roll with it. That's hence the title of Clumsy Love. There were a lot of missteps along the way. So mostly on my part, but we were all kind of going through this together. And I think at the time when she came out to us, there just wasn't a lot of resources that we felt we could turn to. I think there's a lot more now, which is great. And we were, my wife and I were late to the social media game. I don't think we got onto Facebook until 2012. And so I think that sort of became important to us to, like, you know, maybe we document this stuff and, you know, maybe we can share it so it could help someone else.
And throughout the book, you talk about your efforts to relate to Simone's experiences so she felt understood, even though you didn't have the experience of growing up as a trans person. What kind of experiences, what kind of things did you do to try and bridge that gap, especially feeling, as you said, you know, isolated and not having a lot of role models, templates out there to work with?
So I'm an adopted child. So I think, you know, and I had... was adopted when I was, I think, about a month old. And I'd always known that. My parents were always very upfront about that. That became a point of entry, I guess, to connect with Simone. For example, when I went looking for information about my birth parents, I discovered that, you know, for a very brief time, I had a different name. I was Kevin. And, you know, when I was adopted, my parents renamed me Andrew. So obviously that's separate from, you know, Simone's wanting to change her name in the sense of, you know, because of, you know, the sort of masculine, right, the gender connotations of Simon and versus Simone. But it just felt like there was like a point of entry there in a conversation with her about that when the naming thing came up. But also too, just maybe a kind of empathy that I could have for, you know, a kid who felt, you know, maybe a bit different within her own family, because I certainly had felt that way at many times growing up. You know, I gained an appreciation for things my parents had done for me, which maybe at the time I didn't recognize. You know, for example, in the book, it talks about my dad being this really big on sports, and I kind of let him know at a young age that wasn't really for me. He didn't push that. You know, eventually he just sort of said, okay, you're this weird kid, you know, where can I meet you at? And, you know, he found a place to do that. And I didn't really appreciate that until I was much older, until Simone came into my life. And so that sort of informed some of the decisions, you know, I made too about maybe letting, like, Simone kind of lead the dance, so to speak. Let us know, like, who are you? And trying to kind of meet her there, as opposed to saying, this is who we want you to be. And you know, kind of forcing that. So
Andrew Patry is with us, English teacher and writer based in Eau Claire. We're talking about his new book. It's called Clumsy Love, A Father's Journey Parenting His Transgender Daughter. And his daughter, Simone, joins us now, a talented singer. She's an incoming freshman at Lawrence University. She'll double major in English and Spanish. Simone, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I got to ask, what went through your mind when you heard, okay, your dad's going to write a book about being your parent and about your childhood?
I think I remember the first thing I said being, can I get some money from it?
Very practical, yeah.
Yes.
And then, though, I would feel a little reluctant having a person write a book about me. What kind of things were you worried about or maybe excited about to have shared in the book?
I think a good thing to share is about my dead name. At first, I was really, really anxious about having that put out into the world. But as time kind of went on, I reframed my mind and I thought more about, like, this is kind of a reclaiming of that. And so I think I'm most excited for that piece of my life to be shared.
Simone, as your dad just mentioned, in the last maybe 5-6 years, there's been a lot of political talk about transgender people in schools, maybe in particular. What is important to you about sharing your own story rather than having people kind of bat your story and that of other transgender people around, like sort of a political football?
I think I want people to read the real stories from trans people, trans youth and their families, and maybe not reach immediately towards inflammatory news articles. And I want my story to help restore the humanity for trans people and trans youth, because especially right now in today's political climate, humanity has been stripped away from our community. But most importantly, I want my story to help the unseen feel seen, people who may have gone through something similar as I did, or people who may have experienced the complete opposite. For every trans and queer child who feels alone as I did, I want this story to be a blatant, glaring message to them that you are not alone.
Simone, something that struck me as your dad told the story anyway, you were clear from a very early age about your identity. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I tell people that in my mind, I knew I was a girl before people even started like categorizing me as a boy or dressing me up in boys' clothing. So when I was told, hey, boys go on this side, girls go on this side, I was like, why am I going on this side of the room? And so that was quite distressing for me and confusing, and it only got worse until I finally knew the word for what I was feeling, and that was like finally the moment that I felt freed and I was able to be my true self.
Andrew, you write about that, not necessarily, and you talked about it earlier, not necessarily picking up on those signs as early as you wished you had in hindsight.
Yeah, and I think, or in some instances, we were probably just like, we're not even going to go there. That just seemed like transgender, just seemed like this whole other thing that we just were not willing to kind of confront until Simone, you know, kind of forced that. And I guess I just wanted to add one thing to, because Simone brought up the dead name and obviously had her blessing to use that. There is a section, the first half of the book, it is Simone's dead name, so that when we get to the point where the name changes, I wanted the reader to kind of have to like adjust to that the way, you know, Adrian and I and you know, friends and family did. But I think important to say too that I wanted, this book is really meant to be my story as a parent. I don't want to try to tell Simone's story, although hopefully someday Simone will, you know, share her story too. But yeah, I just wanted to kind of be clear about that too, that I wasn't trying to tell her story for her. It's really mine, but she's a part of that story too.
Simone, the book wraps up as you're going into high school. Well, as we talk now, you're getting ready to head to college. Your high school years, what were some of the things, to follow up on the story your dad told, the things you encountered there, for better or worse, the positives and negatives as you experienced high school?
You know, I met so many amazing people. I joined choir, and there I found like a second family. So I made so many friends. I was able to join the a cappella group at Memorial High School and got to perform on the same competition that is seen on Pitch Perfect, which was really, really cool. Just last year, my senior year, I was able to perform a solo. So I got the spotlight, and it was like the best feeling ever. But I do remember my freshman year, I had some issues with people who I'd gone to elementary school with who knew my dead name. And this was during the time that my dad was still writing the book, I think. So I was still a little, you know, apprehensive about that. And they used to call my name, my dead name out every single day after school in the hallway. But I kind of just in that moment knew to reclaim it and just to feel empowered by it and it soon did not affect me as much. But overall, my high school experience was amazing. It was very, very good.
Andrew, you share some difficult moments, discrimination from classmates and others. But throughout the book, though, you found in sometimes surprising places, you found very supportive people in your family and in the community. Can you talk about that side of things a little?
We were so fortunate to, as we were kind of going through this initially, to have our good friends, Rachel and Ari. And then at the time, they just had their daughter, Gita, who's just a year older than Simone, and they just connected at the right time. And they were so supportive, helping us through this. But I think, you know, and of course, my mother was an early champion of Simone. My dad, he was a little more mysterious in terms of how he was feeling about things. But, you know, he, in the book, it talks about how he, you know, shows up to the naming ceremony. But I was also like, one of the things, you know, in venturing out into that world, I think you'll see in the book that I was often just very skeptical of strangers. And I think, you know, part of my journey in the book is recognizing that I don't know if I'll ever be able to, you know, sort of let go of that suspicion of fellow human being, but that I'm learning to kind of rise above that, because it was often, like I said, proved wrong at many turns. My world got much more expanded through this. I'm glad you actually asked that question, Rob, because I feel like that it's easy to get kind of bogged down in all the depressing stuff happening, but to be reminded that there is a lot of light and kindness out there too.
Simone, your dad shared your story in this book, and of course his own story. What did you take away from it? What did you learn about your dad, maybe even about yourself, as he was writing this? And I assume you read at least some of it.
It was actually really interesting, because a lot of the early book is from when I was so little that I don't really remember what happened. So reading it through was kind of like reading a different person's story that was also my story, and it was really weird. But I think reading through the book, it's been really, really healing to see my transness and my story kind of through the lens of my father, and to sort of remember all the stuff that I maybe tried to forget, maybe the negative things, but also there was so, so much positive support and love in my life that I didn't really know that was there. I think a specific one comes to mind is during my naming ceremony, my grandma, who came, said, like, it's about time I have a granddaughter. And I never knew she said that. And that just kind of touched me so, so greatly, because I didn't know she felt that way at all. So it's been really cool to see how people, friends, family reacted to my transness that I didn't know.
And we'll leave it there. Simone, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Rob. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you.
That was Simone Patry, incoming freshman at Lawrence University, planning to double major in English and Spanish. Her father is Andrew Patry, high school English teacher and writer based in Eau Claire. Andrew wrote his new book, Clumsy Love, A Father's Journey Parenting His Transgender Daughter. We've got a conversation coming up on the show with a former competitive figure skater and coach from Wisconsin who's coming out with a memoir. One of the points of the book is the joy of having fun with the sport, even if we're not trying to compete in that sport at a professional or Olympic level.
And we want to hear from you. Is there a sport you've kept doing through the years just for fun, for exercise, maybe for social connection, without a plan to compete at a higher level?
And if your kids do sports, how do you make sure they keep the fun in it? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or you can text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Beatrice Lawrence, Lauren Cox, and Avery Lee Rogers. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.